Welcome to 365. My name is Mark, your host for this episode, and today I have with me Gareth Goodger, who's MVP for Office Services and Services in Exchange, I believe. Gareth.
Yeah, that's correct. First, thanks for having me on the show, Mark. I'm an MVP for Office Service and Services, primarily focusing on Exchange and Exchange Online.
Cool. And where are you based?
So I am based out of Cincinnati, Ohio, starting to hide where I was originally from. I think I'm starting to work well on this American accent, but
not far from,
yeah, I was originally.
You weren't far from me, yeah. Are you? So.
Yeah, I was originally from the UK, and I'm going to say that, you know, people with the Northern accent might, you know, we never really had the Queen's English, so it was probably a little bit easier to lose, right, when you emigrate away.
That's it, yeah. So, true. So you had your own Brexit then a few years ago.
I did. I had my own Brexit, and actually just recently, I've lived in the U.S. for about almost 20 years, and actually just recently became a U.S. citizen. So,
all right, so Trump can't kick you out then, no?
No, I had to make sure I was on the correct side of the Trump wall. And so, yeah.
Cool. Well, thanks for spending the time with us. We'll crack on with a few topics around Exchange, hopefully, and probably start off with Exchange on premises. So, Exchange 2007, is it still around?
It is, and it is going end of life very, very soon. So as we're recording, it's going end of life on April 11th, so about 37 days. So by the time I guess this probably gets up on Channel 9, it's going to be a whole lot less than that. So as of that date, it will be unsupported. There's going to be no more development, so Microsoft's not going to release any more patches. And it's actually arguable if there really has been any patches for it in the last few years, other than like daylight savings type patches. It's going to be unsupported as of April 11th. No more development, and then on top of that, no more tech support, which is really the big one. Mm-hmm. So if you call in with an issue, you're not even going to be able to pay for support. You're kind of going to be directed to, hey, you need upgrade. So
upgrade is the fix if anything breaks. Pretty much.
Yeah, pretty much. And unfortunately, there's still a lot of people on 2007. I'm not running into as many of those migrations as I was, say, last year. Last year, and actually, not even late last year, but I'd say early last year and then late 2015, I was starting to run into a lot of the 07 to 13 type migrations. And I'm still running into those a little bit. I'd say this year I'm more seeing the 2010 to 2016 migrations.
Yeah.
That's usually what I'm seeing. But yeah, and every now and again, I'm still running into somebody that's on Exchange 2003, which has been unsupported for quite a few years. And, you know, and they're just trying to get to 2010. And really, there's no development for even 2010 at this point. Yeah. So
I guess it's really quite difficult for larger businesses. I obviously work for Dell, and we have on-premises Exchange, and we have a mixture of 2007 and 2010. And then we have... give too much away, but then we have another domain, which is 2013. But I guess for smaller companies, it's a no-brainer to get off 2007. But what sort of challenges are larger businesses seeing? What reasons are they giving you for saying, well, I'm still staying with 2007 even after the end of life support?
I'd say there's not really a reason. Like, it's not that they're opposed to upgrading. I think it's just a matter of resourcing. You know, we just don't have the skill set internally. We don't have the resources. We don't have the bandwidth or the manpower. And maybe even the budget.
Yeah.
So that's usually what I think it comes down to, is just like they need a lot of help.
Yeah.
Or there's like a thousand other projects coming up. You know, for them it might be, yeah, we're still trying to get rid of all these Windows Server 2003 boxes, mm-hmm. or even heck, Windows Server 2000 boxes.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's usually a lot going on, and Exchange was built well. I mean, if you're on 2007, it'll keep running.
Yeah.
A lot of times I think it's kind of an afterthought that, you know, hey, that this is okay, but we've got these other servers that are just burning down.
Yeah.
You know, we need to get these moved first. So, I think a lot of organizations now are seeing the benefit of Office 365, and they've been holding off, and now it's, you know, I think we're certainly seeing a lot more migrations to Office 365 for the large enterprises. You know, originally the first few years it was, you know, it was the SMB space that was mostly embracing it, but now we're, yeah, we're seeing massive, huge migrations, you know, 150,000 mailboxes going to Office 365.
And can we get, can people with 2007 Exchange, can they get to Office, sorry, to Exchange Online in one hop?
Yeah, I mean, there is options out there. I would say they're probably more geared towards the SMB space, so you could do, you know, like the cutover and stage migrations. Those migrations are kind of ugly, so I would typically recommend, hey, at least try and get a 2010 box in there, if not 2013, and let's, so you have the advantage of being able to do the hybrid configuration wizard and going, you know, having a hybrid connection for that, you know, that rich coexistence. Definitely for a large company, and even small companies, I usually say, you know, the hybrid configuration was now is so easy.
Yeah, I find that as well with you know, people in Skype world say, well, do Skype hybrid, and they think it's a larger task than it really is. And it's like, literally, guys, it's like five steps and you're up and running. It's Microsoft have refined it quite well.
Yeah, they certainly have, and especially once the hybrid now is actually kind of broken out from Exchange, and that when you're hitting that hybrid link now, it's actually, you know, downloading the latest bits from a server. I think that has certainly been massively improved. There's a lot less errors. I mean, you know, there's still errors, right, when you're running the hybrid, but there's a lot less. I mean, I run into way less issues than I used to, say, in like the, you know, the early 2013 days when the hybrid, you know, the configuration wizard was out. Mm-hmm. And it's nice that they've opened up that same hybrid configuration wizard for 2010. That opens up a lot of doors for people as well. Yeah. So, honestly, a lot of the time, running the hybrid configuration wizard isn't the biggest piece. The biggest piece is usually them getting their identity correct. It's running things like, you know, ID fix and making sure that their UPNs are correct. Yeah. That's probably the most time-consuming piece, is making sure that their identity is where it needs to be so they can do directory synchronization. That is...
Yeah, I 100% agree with you. We see that in the Skype world as well, because obviously we have that dependency, because we work with your product quite closely for UM and all sorts and free busy information. So yeah, cool. In terms of 2010 support, has that been it? Roadmap to go end of life anytime soon? Has that been
published? Yeah, it is published. I mean, most of those life cycles are published fairly, pretty much when the product's released. So the general rule of thumb that I find is it's a 10-year life cycle. So Exchange 2010 will go out in 2020. And then 2013 is always, you know, it's already 10 years out of 2013. And then, you know, you can assume 2016 is going to be out in, you know, 2026. Hopefully by the time we've all retired, because we're super rich from what we do. And
well, or made redundant when Microsoft take everyone to the cloud and they don't need.
Yeah, there's certainly a lot of people. You know, I think there's a lot of studies and surveys out there that are showing that there's still a lot more people in on-prem with Exchange than there is in the cloud. It's not to say that the scales are certainly not tipping in the cloud's favor. There's obviously a lot more people, I would say, that are going to Office 365 than, you know, are going to Exchange 2016 or something like that. But yeah, there's still a lot.
Yeah, I think it was Ignite last year. I mean, I already got told this by proxy. I didn't attend myself, but there was a breakout session where Microsoft asked, who in this room's got Exchange Online? And it was about 10% of the room, and it was like, who's got Exchange on-prem? And it was 90% of the room. So
yeah,
that shocked them.
Well, it's funny too, because that was kind of the same way, I think, in the Ignite prior to that as well. It's like the last two Ignites, that really hasn't changed. I would say that, yeah, there's certainly a lot more people going to the cloud, but I'd say there's certainly a lot of people on-prem. I don't see the Exchange on-prem product going away anytime soon. I think it might get to the point where we would certainly see, you know, like that always green mentality, right? What we're seeing with like Windows 10 and System Center and stuff like that, where, you know, we just see, hey, this is Exchange and there's no year attached to it, and then it's just CUs forever or something like that, right?
Is that happening for Exchange in 2016 now? Because that's definitely happening for Skype.
Not yet. So we've got 2013 that's up to CU15. We've got 2016 that's up to CU4. And by the end of March, CU5 should be out. It's usually, the CUs are released on a quarterly cycle. So sometime in March, probably middle to end of March, that CU5 will drop. I would expect, because you can't obviously, I don't think they would just call it Exchange 2016 forever. I think there's going to be another major release.
It'll just drop the year and
just
be Exchange.
That would be, I would suspect that would be what would happen. And then, like that, because it seems like all of Microsoft is kind of following that model, whatever product group you're in. I mean, we're seeing that with Windows 10. I think Windows Server is going to go that way eventually. So I would expect that across the board, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, obviously Windows 10 is their last OS, they say, isn't it?
So yeah, yeah.
It makes sense that all the products to go that way. I mean, I have a perception of the products in the cloud, and we've got Exchange Online, we've got Skype Online, we've got SharePoint, and what have you. And we see it with Microsoft Teams. They leverage all the core engines of Exchange, Skype, and other bits and pieces that's in the Office 365 ecosystem. So generally we'll lose the name, we'll lose the brand, it'll just be email.
Right.
It'll just be, I can send an instant message. I don't really care what the brand of the product is underneath. So it's definitely going that way, but it's good for the end users.
I think the lines are definitely blurring between the products, especially as we're seeing more integration with things like Office 365 groups. And, it's kind of becomes, where truly is one product, I mean, we know, but where truly is one product from a brand perspective ending and the other one beginning? So I think, the lines are definitely blurring between the products, and I don't think that's a bad thing. I really don't. I wonder if that's where, I mean, we're seeing that now, not just with the product branding, but also, if you're going to become an MCSE, now you're an MCSE in productivity. You're not an MCSE in messaging or Skype or SharePoint, you're basically an MCSE in productivity, which encompasses the entire Office 365 product set. So I think that's definitely interesting as well.
Yeah, sure. I mean, in terms of Exchange 2016 now, we mentioned that we've got a few CUs now. So anybody on our older CUs, like CU2, 3, is there any problems with that and reasons why they should really get on the update bandwagon for that?
Yeah, there's definitely reasons to upgrade. CU3 came out back last September, and you always want to be, from a supportability standpoint, you want to be on the latest CU. But the CU3 was a big one, just because, one, it added support for Server 2016. There was some issues around that. we'll talk about that maybe a little bit later. But CU3 added, like I said, Windows Server 2016. But I think the even bigger one is it finally delivered on the reduction in network utilization. So what Microsoft did was originally, so if you had a DAG and say you had 8 servers in that DAG or whatever, what would happen is every server would reach across the network to rebuild its index from the active copy. Right. So you've got 7 of the servers reaching across. Now they have each server going off its own copy of the database to rebuild its index. And as a result, you're seeing up to 40% less network utilization by Exchange, and that number is going to skew up and down based on maybe how big your DAG is or your database is. And the Microsoft Exchange server calculator has been changed to reflect that. But the big thing is, and I think this is where it's really key, so if you've got a DAG that's stretched across multiple data centers over that very costly WAN link, Exchange is going to be using less resources. So I think it's very important to get up to that latest, obviously CU4, but at least be on CU3 or greater, just to get that benefit, especially if you're on a stretch DAG, because that's a great win to go back to your C levels and say, hey, guess what? Exchange uses less bandwidth now. But also if you're on older versions, Exchange 2013 never realized that benefit. So even though you might be on the latest and greatest CU of 2013, you're not actually getting that benefit unless you go to 2016. So.
But there was a bug, wasn't there, in CU3 that broke DAGs?
I wouldn't say it was necessarily in CU3. So it was really a bug that was on the Windows Server Team side. It was actually the Windows Server Team side that acknowledged and fixed that bug. But it was effectively breaking. So you could run Exchange on Server 2016 until you try to build a DAG, and then it broke horribly. It was related to there was like IIS worker processes, I think, that were restarting randomly, and as soon as you introduced that DAG and rebooted the server. So the actual fix, I mean, even though it looked like it was CU-free because CU-free said, hey, we support Server 2016, but oh, it's broken. Yeah, it was actually really on the Windows Server team side that the issue. And it was actually, technically, it was broken for multiple products. It was just the Exchange is the only one that really uses this particular feature. So,
sure,
yeah.
I mean, obviously, was it Server 2016? Did it come out, was it August, September last year?
Gosh, I don't remember.
whatever. But are you seeing many people taking that jump from 2012 R2? Because obviously that server OS seems to be pretty solid these days.
Yeah.
People actually wanting to take the jump right now to 2016 and accept these niggles?
Yeah, because the CU-free came out in September. I'm not seeing it yet. I haven't seen any projects where somebody's gone with Server 2016 yet. So I haven't seen it yet. Most of the people that I see adopting it, it's just been in labs so far.
Yeah.
I'm sure it'll come. I'm sure it'll definitely come. But yeah, most for the most part, everybody's still on 2012 R2 when it comes to Exchange 2016.
Yeah, they'll wait for Windows Server 2016 with update.
Yeah, yeah, with web, SP1 and
the unbranded SP1.
So, whatever that number is.
Yeah. So with the 2016, it required a few less prerequisites and had a different interface, if I believe.
Yeah, so one of the nice things that the Exchange team introduced in CU4 is they actually, you know, they looked and said, you know, oh, wait, we're kind of requiring you to apply more prerequisites than you actually need. And that kind of stemmed originally from Server 2008 R2 days. What you needed the desktop experience to get, you know, Windows experience, the Media Foundation. And I think by 2012, it's like, oh, you could actually install that component without desktop experience. So, it's nice. They've realized that in, the latest CU builds. So now it doesn't require the entire desktop experience. So, you know, it's kind of weird. You would have to put that on, and then you're like, wait, I've got Windows Store on my server and Ink and Media Player. And, yeah, so that's all fixed now. You don't need that. So that, and that's good because, it's just reducing, one, your attack vector, but, two, also, there's less products that are going to get updated, you know, on your update cycle. Yeah. So, yeah.
They can go longer for updates and or potentially have smaller update windows and what have you. So
that's always a good thing.
So, I mean, Skype eventually supports .NET 4.6.2. That broke a lot of things in our world. Does 4.6 to CU4 include support for the latest version of .NET?
Yes. Yeah, so in CU3, they added very limited support for 4.6.2. It was only if you were running like on Windows Server 2016, and as we kind of said, nobody's really doing that yet, unless it's in lab. So 4.6 in CU4 and also in Exchange 2013 CU15, they added full .NET 4.6.2 support. On Windows 2012 and Windows 2016. Yeah, so it's fully supported now as of the latest round of updates. And then actually going forward, so in CU5, whenever that drops, and then I guess we would be on what, CU16 for 2013, it's actually going to be a mandatory prereq that you have to be at that level. So, it's getting there for sure.
Cool. And Exchange Online, obviously, that's a hot topic for everyone. Are there any big announcements in Exchange Online? I mean, it's been a pretty static product for, it's a wrong choice of word. It doesn't seem to be a lot happening from an outsider's perspective, but obviously you can tell me differently.
Yeah, I mean, we could probably just look at Paul and Tony's and Michael's book, right? The Office 365 for IT Pros, and you know how many updates those guys are making. I mean, it's like weekly updates, I think. So, and that's a quick plug for their book. If you guys don't have it, you know, go get it. It's an excellent book. It's the big thing for Exchange, I think, right now, and this is already rolled out, so it's not exactly like breaking news. But most, you know, I think a lot of your customers are probably realizing it now, is that, hey, my mailbox is no longer 50 gigs, it's 100 gigs. It's doubled in size. So that's really the biggest thing we've seen. And I think Microsoft completed that rollout maybe in January or February. So, it's been recent. Some people on the early cycles were getting it, I think last year. But yeah, that's finally rolled out. Right. And it kind of brings into question, I mean, what is the future of having an archive mailbox, right? Is that even relevant anymore today? I mean, certainly if you've got more than 100 gigs of mail, but, you know, is it relevant, you know, even on-prem maybe?
Do people actually need 50 gigs worth of mail, let alone 100?
You'd be surprised. The big ones I run into, this is going to be a little scary, but I've actually run into 150, 160, 200 gig mailboxes on Exchange 03, 2000 pre, which is scary that those don't break all the time. but yeah, no, you do see it. Usually it's the big ones for me, I think, have been shared mailboxes where accounts receivables using it or something like that, and or accounts payable, and every single invoice ever is saved in a shared mailbox. And before you know it, you've got 150. And I've even seen it where they've been like, yeah, we even put it on 12-month retention where anything over 12 months gets put somewhere else, and it's still 150 gigabyte mailbox. So, yeah, I've definitely seen some of that in these large organizations.
When I used to work at a school, I used to get upset when teachers wanted a 4-gig mailbox.
Yeah, I think it comes down to people using Exchange like a file system, and I think the Exchange product groups and the other product groups in Office 365 have certainly done a lot to say, hey, okay, here's modern attachments, and you know, you could actually keep those attachments in your OneDrive or your SharePoint. So I think there's a lot of combat to that, but I think it's, you know, trying to change that human behavior. There's still a lot of people that, and I do it too, you know, where we just send the attachment by email because it's easier sometimes, right? Yeah.
Multiple revisions of the same attachment.
Yeah. So who's got the latest? Oh, maybe we should use SharePoint for this. Or an Office 365 group, right?
But
you see it. And as far as the archive, I mean, if we go back to on-prem, the original the big argument for archiving was that, back in like, say, the 2007 days is that, hey, storage is super expensive. Per gigabyte cost is super expensive. We need to keep, we want to have high performance storage for our user experience, but we also want to make sure that older emails maybe go to a lower tier, cheaper storage, because the argument is that 90% of all emails over 6 months are never even looked at again. So the archive mailbox was kind of created to allow you to put a separate, effectively just a second mailbox for the user, but put it on a database that was on much slower storage, and then use like retention policies to move that stuff around. And so that way you only had the latest stuff on the fastest disk, and all the older stuff went on a slower disk. Mm-hmm. That's kind of changed. So one, we've had twofold for this, right? One, storage keeps getting faster and cheaper. Yeah. And two, Exchange for every major revision is using a lot less IOPS than it did before. So just going from Exchange 2003 to 2010, and there was like a 90% reduction, the number of IOPS per mailbox. And that continues to drop. I don't know how they keep doing it. I mean, the guys that are part of the ESE database group, I mean, they're just brilliant. I mean, I think from 2010 to 2013, it was, again, like another 50% drop between those versions. And then when 2016 came out, I think at one of the Ignites, they were like, yeah, we're at like 22% IO reduction again, but we believe it might be higher than that. And I haven't seen a metric since then, but, I think they were thinking it was closer to like the 30 range. So... Wow.
Wow. I mean, the disk coming cheaper and obviously the IO getting lower obviously reduces the spec, just makes it more affordable and accessible.
Yeah, I mean, you're kind of putting everything then at that point, you're saying, well, Exchange can run, if you look at the Exchange best practices or the preferred architecture, I should say, it's like, and you look at what Microsoft's running this stuff on in the cloud, they're like, yeah, we're not putting it on SSDs, we're not putting on high enterprise storage, we're putting on it on this, midline storage. There's actually some really good Ignite sessions out there where they talk about how many IOPS the average database uses, the average mailbox uses, and it is super low. They're saying, yeah, just use JBOD, you don't even need RAID, just use JBOD.
And with the midline SAS, the 10K drives, you can have, 3 terabytes a drive or something?
Yeah, it's basically midline commodity storage, and at that point you're like, well, why do we even need to separate the storage tiers? Just leave everything in one mailbox, right? So I think archive mailboxes are really becoming irrelevant. And I think, I don't know if it was last Ignite or maybe an Ignite prior to that, there was the announcement that archives were going to be auto-expanding and all that kind of stuff, right? And that conversation's kind of evaporated. I think the focus is, I just think the focus is going to be on making these primary mailboxes bigger and bigger and bigger. Why have an archive?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, your mail's all in one place. There's no switching between two.
Yeah.
And all that type of thing. Less complicated as well. So that's a good thing. Obviously, we mentioned Office 365 groups. That's a big thing in Office 365 right now, right across Exchange, Skype, and SharePoint, and what have you. Biggest question is, do you ever see 365 groups taking the place of distribution lists? Or maybe, why would you choose a 365 group versus a distribution list in Exchange Online, for instance?
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways it kind of goes back to the same argument on, you know, on the on-prem side. Why would you have used a site mailbox over a distribution list? Or why would you use a shared mailbox over a distribution list? I think that's the same kind of conversation. When do you use a shared mailbox, or when do you use a distribution list? And, you know, a distribution list is a great way to, and there's certainly use cases for both and the strengths for both. For me, a distribution list is still great for, like, company-wide communications. You know, you have that all employees type distribution list, or you have maybe geographic distribution lists, right, where, you know, the CEO or something like that wants to make a company-wide announcement. I think that is still perfect for your distribution list, where it's kind of like, well, okay, we just need to send this message out to everybody, but we don't necessarily need everybody to read, or we don't need to store that, right? There's no real collaborative element around it. I think it's just a broadcast out, here's the latest company news, or maybe it's like the company newsletter or something like that, right? It's a very one-way, I think that's maybe the way to define it. It's very much a one-way communication. And I think that's where distribution lists really make perfect sense. I think as far as, Office 365 groups and to an extension shared mailboxes, I think that's where your collaboration comes in, where it's very much a two-way conversation. And certainly you need like a historical record of the conversation. So I think it works really well for like groups of people. I would say more towards the small groups of people who are maybe collaborating on a project.
Yeah.
And they want the history of all the project emails, and they want that central OneNote, and they want a central repository of their documents. I think that makes perfect sense. Because then, you know, one case scenario for that might be, okay, we hire or we bring somebody else into this group, and now they have a historical record of every conversation that's been had, you know, maybe every decision that's been made. And you can't do that with a distribution list, right? So for a distribution list, it's like, oh, well, let me go find all these emails that may have had and try and resend you to get you up to speed. So I think there's some very clear-cut use cases. And I think, you know, when it comes down to it, you know, they're there for business reasons, right? What is the business purpose? If it's a one-way communication, again, like I said, probably a distribution list.
Yeah.
If it's a two-way collaborative effort, it's an Office 365 group. Or if you don't need, you know, all the bells and whistles, it might just be a shared mailbox.
Yeah, sure. And obviously there was a big announcement, well, my biggest relative term, I guess, but Microsoft made an announcement that they're getting rid of clutter, I believe.
Yeah, so clutter has been replaced with Focus Inbox. So clutter was Microsoft pulling into a different view the things that it didn't think you needed to look at. So things like potentially like newsletters or, you know, it's kind of that machine learning. It's like, hey, they always, you know, it's like they never open this on time. They never look at it. Maybe they just delete it every time. So it's kind of getting rid of what they didn't think was important to you. Actually, that's a wrong term. Not getting rid of, kind of just putting out of sight, out of mind, what they didn't think you would, you know, you really needed to see right away. Focused inbox is more based on, you know, not what you don't need to see, but what they believe you do need to see. So the focus is on, we're going to show you the emails that of people you communicate with a lot, or we're going to show you emails from your boss who you communicate with a lot. So it's kind of a shift of mentality, right? It's a shift of, you know, we're not going to hide what we don't, you know, we're not going to hide what you don't see. We're going to just kind of promote and show what we think you do see. So it's kind of kind of a shift in mentality.
I guess as well, the users obviously need to be told to expect Focus Mailbox, because I'm guessing some emails could go well, not missing, but they might not see their regular inbox, I would imagine.
Yeah, it's I believe it's all rolled out now to everybody. So yeah,
Okay.
it's yeah,
Is that something? Is it something we can turn off or choose to turn it on for? Is it a user setting?
yeah, the clutter has been completely replaced, so it's not like you can say, "Oh, I want to go back to clutter. I preferred that." The clutter's been completely replaced by focused
Right.
inbox. So yeah, it's something that's yeah, it's kind of happened. It's like, you know, it's one of the drawbacks, right, of using Office 365. So Microsoft gives you
Yeah.
features and they take features away, and that's where you lose the control a little bit. So yeah, it's kind of yeah, it's kind of this is what you're getting now. You're not getting clutter anymore. You're getting focused inbox, and I think it makes sense. You know, I think it's hard because it might make sense to some people, but not others. I think, you know, there's a certain group of people that say, I'd rather Microsoft take away what I don't want to see. But now, you know, we've got this, okay, we're going to promote what we think you would want to see. So I think there's potentially like a, you know, like a left brain, right brain kind of a change there. Yeah, it's tough. I actually don't really use Focused Inbox a whole lot, but then I never used Clutter a whole lot either. So, but maybe I'm more of a unique case. I know there's some other MVPs out there with some interesting opinions on this change. So,
Yeah, I must admit I'm traditionally just an inbox
yeah.
guy. I don't, I mean, we've seen focused inbox in Outlook Consumer for a while,
Yeah,
just
the
through the Outlook
Outlook.com.
app.
Yeah.
And I personally hated it and just turned it off, and I just want all my emails by date. I was the date they were received, and then I worked through them.
Yeah.
But I guess I'm kind of old-fashioned in that way, so.
Yeah, I think so. I'm similar in a lot of ways with some of those new features, right? So for example, I'm still a per message view kind of guy. I still the per conversations, you know, where it kind of groups together. I see the use of that, but for me, I'm more of a chronological kind of guy where I'm like, I want to address these as they arrive versus maybe address them by conversation. And I occasionally switch to conversation view when it makes sense on a, you know, when I'm trying to clean up some stuff maybe. But yeah, it's all down to personal preference on a lot of those things, right? It's you got to do what makes you most productive, right?
That's it, and that's the reason why Microsoft give you all these features, right? So you can find the right one for you.
Yeah, it kind of goes back to the early days of, you know, even operating systems, right? When you're in your Windows 95 or whatever, and you're like, well, there's 10 different ways I can get to this option, and you use the way that makes sense to you. And yeah, I think it's with Office 365. There's, like I said, there's a little less control on when features roll out. I mean, you can certainly set up your tenant for like first release and general release and stuff like that. But even then, you're still kind of, you know, subject to features that have come and gone away. I mean, one of the ones that springs to mind of a feature that's gone away was the public website. When Microsoft was offering that, hey, you could run your public website, you know, in Office 365, and I think they determined, hey, there's really not that many people that are using it. We're just going to go ahead and kill that feature. So,
I throw everyone to
yeah,
GoDaddy.
and I think there's some people that are still using it. I don't know if they've officially. I know there was like dates announced of when you've got to get off of the program,
Right.
but I think those are still. Yeah, I don't think
Still
that
cut.
date has officially hit yet.
It's probably not doing any harm. I
Yeah.
guess.
I think they're definitely. I think they definitely cut off people that can sign up for it. But I think as far as people moving their stuff out of there, I don't think that date's hit yet. But yeah, we have to Google that and put that in the show notes maybe. I mean Bing. We'll Bing that and put that
Google, what was that?
in the show notes.
The other question, well, there's always a conversation around public folders. Will they ever die?
Yeah, probably one day. I mean, so Microsoft's been trying to kill them for a very long time, and you know, customers are always saying no, bring them back, and you know, the customer wins, right? There was definitely a massive shift when 2013 came out. So we got rid of the public folder database and ugly the public folder replication. I think was the bane of every admin ever. So that was the first big thing, I think, was when modern public folders came out, and you know, then your public folders stored in a mailbox, and they can have their high availability through the DAG. So it was leveraging all the existing, you know, mailbox database architecture, and I think that was massive because we got rid of these dedicated databases, and we got rid of the, you know, the horrible public folder replication and all the issues you could have with that. So I think for me, that was massive. I kind of said, okay, when the modern public folders came out, I'm like, yeah, these are cool again. I can deal with this. There's certainly a lot of efforts to get rid of it. Microsoft has a number of programs out there. If you're a TAP partner, where your TAP is where you get the technical previews, you can sign up for that and try and get in that program. The issue with TAP is though you are making these updates and changes in your production environment, but you do have kind of the bat phone directly back to the Microsoft engineers if you have issues. Mm-hmm. But there's a number of programs in TAP right now. Yeah. A lot of them are revolving around public folders. One is, moving your modern public folders from on-prem to Office 365. But some of the bigger ones are getting your public folders moved to like Office 365 groups. There are third-party products that do that right now, but it looks like based on these, TAP program announcements, Microsoft's trying to add some native migration support for that. So that'll be really cool. So I think, we'll see a lot more, and certainly with a lot more people, maybe with their startups, they're just going straight to Office 365, right? Brand new company, they just go to Office 365. They probably will never leverage public folders. They'll probably go straight to Office 365 groups or DLs or shared mailboxes. So I think, I would say public folders are on decline because I think the primary driver of those are on-prem people. I don't think, anybody's jumping into Office 365 and saying, a brand new person Office 365 and saying, oh, I need to use public folders, right?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So, obviously, another opportunity on tap is Office Graph. I mean, I must admit, I don't know anything about this other than fundamentally what it supposedly does.
So it's basically their machine learning, right? I mean, it's powering things in Office 365. And I think what's interesting is, so if you have that hybrid connection, it sounds like, and I'm not in this program, so I don't have the details of it. I mean, I'm kind of just going off what their blog posts are saying, but it kind of sounds like, we are bringing that machine learning to, we're not bringing it in on-prem. I think we're just enabling the ability to plug into that through your hybrid connections. I think, where you might have benefited from Graph for your Office 365 mailboxes, I think that Graph's going to reach over to the on-prem mailboxes and let them take advantage of that as well. So I don't think it's not to say that Graph is coming on-prem. That would never happen. But I think it's just going to say Graph is going to be available for your hybrid connection, and I think that's what's going to happen.
Well, that's really good, extending the cloud into your private cloud, as it were, or into your data center. And I think that's probably an acknowledgement that Microsoft realized that hybrid is the future, at least. For the next foreseeable
number. Yeah, and just to clarify that as well, because I don't know if I explained that too well. We're not going to see Graph servers on-prem or anything like that. I think it's just a matter of, hey, there's going to be these APIs that Exchange on-prem will use that it'll call out to your cloud and be able to use Graph for workloads, or Graph will be able to reach into your on-prem and do machine learning against your on-prem as well as what it currently does in Office 365. Yeah. And I think that's what we're going to see. And it's kind of cool. So even though you can sign up for the TAP program, I don't know when this change happened, but I know when I was recently in PowerShell, I think I was doing an integration with Skype. Obviously when you're doing that, you do these partner applications. And I was like, I did a get partner application command. I'm like, wait, there's a Graph partner application in here now too.
Yeah.
And it's not a command that I run very often because, how often are you integrating Skype and Exchange? It's like you set it and forget it, right? I was kind of surprised to see that there was an entry in there for some Graph APIs. So it seems like there's potentially some building blocks already in, everybody's version of Exchange. Well, assuming you're running on probably a certain CU, but I was kind of surprised to see that. So it's kind of cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's Microsoft's next big thing, is it? The whole machine learning, AI, and all that type of thing. And they want to own your business profile of your user. So what they used for using email, what they used for sending instant messaging, for instance, just give you that insight to say, hey, your business as a unit is working productively well or not so well, and these are the areas where we think you can focus on to make improvements.
Yeah, I would say that, if there's anybody watching this that's like, oh, I want to be a developer and I don't know where to start out, I'd say if you become a developer in something that does machine learning, that's going to be huge for the next over the next 10 years. I think it's going to be massive.
Yeah.
You know, if somebody's trying to get in the developer space.
Yeah. Then you will be retiring with a multimillionaire.
Yeah. So I think it's one of two things, right? You either become a developer in machine learning, or you develop the next HoloLens, and then
teleportation, isn't it?
Can I get my email, my HoloLens? Actually, it's actually funny because I've seen, what was it, Skype in the HoloLens. Yeah. That's more on your arenas. Have you seen any of that stuff yet?
No, it's more for Skype Consumer right now.
Okay.
So they were Skype Consumer before. HoloLens had an API for Skype Consumer. I must admit, I'm not a dev, so I wouldn't know where to start. I mean, I'm just starting to get my hang around PowerShell.
Gosh, could you imagine Skype for Business on the HoloLens, though? That would be amazing.
Yeah, I mean, that's the way they're going, right? And
yeah.
for sure, if you watch the videos, and it is going to go that way, and have those virtual meetings in, you know, almost 4D. That'd be really good. I think after HoloLens, that's going to be great. But where do we go from there? It would be nice to be able to put your hand out in that virtual meeting, shake a guy's hand, and feel the pressure of a handshake.
Yeah, that'd be pretty cool.
You know. So you know, we get into and then the step after that is just Stargate. So
you know.
So,
yeah, then I'd be like, okay, my handshake isn't very good. I need to pretend, and you just you know, you turn up that setting for handshake strength,
yeah,
right?
That's it, yeah. That's it, electric shock. But I think it will come. I think the step before that will be getting rid of the headset and having, you know, the pop-up things that you see on Star Trek and Star Wars and what have you, the pop-up holograms and what have you.
Actual holograms, yeah.
Yeah, you know, that'll be the next thing. But then... but yeah, we'll see.
The future is now.
That's it. Yeah, you know, a lot of those things in Back to the Future and what have you have been made reality. So
yeah, absolutely.
You know, it's
I'm still waiting on the hoverboard, though. I mean, where's that?
Well, we've got hoverboards over here, but they still got wheels, so they're not really hoverboards, right?
Yeah, I think I saw one that was like, I don't know what they did. It was like, it was like purely magnetic or something weird like that. It was like, that's not a real hoverboard. That's just like magnets.
That's it, yeah.
Like. And I think
those Nike trainers like, that self-tie themselves.
Oh, yeah. And the clothes that, the clothes that dry themselves as well?
That's it, yeah.
And I just need a DeLorean now, so.
Yeah, they're expensive, they are.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I did see one. Like I said, I'm around here in Cincinnati. It looked like somebody actually, it wasn't just a DeLorean, but it looked like a prop car, you know, like where they had actually kitted it out to look like Back to the Future. And I was trying to get a good picture of it. And this is, you know, don't take photos and drive. That public service announcement there. But no, I couldn't get a good picture of it. It was, but I'm like, I was having some flashbacks for childhood there when I saw that prop car for the DeLorean.
Did it get to 88 miles an hour?
It was going faster than me when I was stuck in traffic. So, but I did see it shoot past me, and I'm like, come on, you can do it, you can do it.
All right. Well, thanks very much for coming on to the show. We've reached the end of our time now. It's been a pleasure, and we'll do it again sometime.
Absolutely.
Cool. Thank you very much.